So overall, are there major differences in the compromise bill from what the governor had first proposed? And if so, what are they?
Well, as you might imagine, with a bill that is about 200 pages long, when you sit down with the Senate and Assembly to go over it, you know, there are a lot of small tweaks and changes that are made in the bill, you know, just to clarify things and so on. Probably the most visible change is the addition of an advisory council to the Justice Center that would have representation from family members, from advocates, from provider organizations to help the Justice Center as it's adopting regulations and policies that affect six different human service systems in the state and all the providers that those agencies in turn regulate. So I think that's probably the most visible change that's been made.
Do you think that makes the bill better? I mean, it adds a little bit of independence, eyes looking at things, right?
Yeah, I think what it does is really provide a structured way for getting advice on the potential impact of proposed regulations and, you know, seeking the advice, really, of a representative group of people before new policies are put in place. And as you know, it's not at all uncommon for state agencies to have advisory councils for exactly this reason. I think it's a good addition.
Well, what about some of the ideas raised by Michael Carey, having security cameras, periodic drug tests for people who work with the disabled, curbing you know, excessive overtime, as was the case in his son's death? Is there any of that in the bill?
Well, you know, I think security cameras and using cameras as investigative tools is something that is done when there is a reason to do it. You know, as an example, if one looks at the experience of the special prosecutor for nursing homes, which you know, deals with a similar problem in the nursing home environment, they've used cameras when you know, performing investigations into injuries of unknown origin. I think there is a place for doing that, and that's a tool that's available to any investigative agency and to a prosecutorial agency.
But you're saying there has to be a complaint first. You couldn't
there
just blanket.
There has to be a reason. It doesn't necessarily have to be a complaint, but there has to be a reason to do it. Because let's not forget, we're talking about you know, approximately a million people who are being served in different types of settings. A lot of the people who are being served live in homes like you and I do. They live in apartments. And there are significant issues, obviously, when you talk about putting their lives under surveillance. There's got to be a pretty good reason to do it. And I think as an investigative tool, when there is a reason to do it, it should be a tool that's available, and it is available.
And what about a periodic drug test? You think that's, as they do, I guess, for prison workers, guards?
Yeah, I don't know what the policy or civil service rules are around doing that. But again, if there is a basis for drug testing people, and I think it's done right now as part of the reforms that Commissioner Burke has put into place in OPWDD. I think the issue that has been raised by some people is, you know, that's fine going forward, but, you know, there is a workforce that's already there. And, you know, the proposal has been put forward to drug test everybody who works in this field, even the people who already been hired.
Yeah, so you can't change the rules in the middle.
You know, I think you have to be conscious of the fact that we live in a society where there are laws and rules that give employees rights. And, you know, we ought not to be treating every employee as a potential criminal, you know, unless they've given you some reason to think that.
So how is this going to make a difference going forward? And what kind of things do you have to do to make sure that it's implemented correctly?
Well, I think one of the significant things that this bill does is, you know, we have a real dizzying maze of laws and regulations defining abuse and predicting the ways in which agencies ought to respond to it. And they vary from one agency to another. And, you know, we've got six different agencies, and there are providers in the community that have licenses from multiple state agencies and are therefore governed by inconsistent and conflicting rules. So I think a very big thing that this bill does is it creates a single set of common rules that apply to all providers, all service systems in how they deal with abuse and neglect and reporting serious incidents. And I think one cannot overestimate the importance of that clarity, because it affects the way in which you train employees. It affects the ways in which employees that move from one program to another are affected. The second thing that it does is creates a very easy system for reporting. That there's a hotline. It's staffed 24/7. It can take anonymous reports. There's a system for mandated reporters. There are penalties for not reporting. There are penalties for failing to act on reports. So I think it raises the bar on protecting vulnerable people. The third thing is we have a register that, instead of just dealing with one agency, deals across all human service systems for people who have been found responsible for egregious or repeated acts of abuse, and they are barred from working with vulnerable people ever again. So I think that's a very significant improvement. And then having a special prosecutor to assist local district attorneys or to work in tandem with them or to take over cases and prosecute cases of abuse and neglect. There have been a lot of reports that have been made to law enforcement in the past that, because of the complexity of these types of cases and the difficulties of both investigating and prosecuting them, the response has really not been as effective as it ought to be. And so having a specialized resource to do these types of investigations and to prosecute crimes so that, you know, people who are especially vulnerable have the same protection of the penal law as the rest of us have, I think that's very important. There is a lot of work to be done to implement all this and to, you know, to bring an idea into reality and into a functioning entity. And that's one of the reasons why the effective date, is put off into the next year, because there's an enormous amount of planning that is going to need to be done to create the infrastructure to implement the law.
Why do you think that this did go on for so long with no, you know, improvements as the ones that you mentioned in the bill? Do you think prior administrations dropped the ball? I mean, happening?
Governor Cuomo made an interesting observation at one of the cabinet meetings that I attended. You know, he talked about, his view that, government had gone through a period of both atrophy and apathy. And many functions in government, not just in this area, but in lots of areas, that had been functioning reasonably well, just sort of seemed to deteriorate into a dysfunctional state. And I think this is clearly an area where that has happened. And it's obviously one of the more urgent ones to fix, because, you know, there are not only the million New Yorkers who are receiving services from these agencies, but all of them have families. And this thing affects the peace of mind of family members more acutely than almost anything else.
Yeah, it's a lot more than just maybe getting your driver's license being a nuisance, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it affects real people.
Yeah. So I think that it has a sense of urgency. I think there's also cycles that go on in any large enterprise. You know, 40 years ago, the state was dealing with the scandal of Willowbrook. And out of that scandal, we developed one of the largest and best systems of community services for people with disabilities. And there are, literally generations of kids who have grown up with disabilities who've never had the prospect of going into an institution. And I think this is a cycle of reform that is, going to raise the bar not only on New York, but it's going to serve as a national standard for how states deal with this problem of abuse. Because when I was researching this, my initial thought was there's got to be a model someplace else that we can look at and figure out what we can learn from it. And what I discovered is that all of the other states, like New York, have separate agencies dealing with separate populations and very often separate sets of rules by how they go about doing it. And, when you step back and think about it, the obligation to keep vulnerable people safe is the same obligation, whether it's a child who is in a special educational residential school or it's a adult with severe intellectual disabilities who is in a group home somewhere. And there's no reason to express that obligation in six different ways.
So nobody's really done this before.
Nobody's done this before, and that's why there's been such an incredible amount of interest from other states on what we're doing here in New York.
So a lot of eyes will be watching.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.